Samantha Hunt is here with me in Studio 360. She wrote the novel The Invention of Everything Else. Samantha, you must have studied this strange period of his life where he was working in this mountain lab.
Yeah. You know, in the time he spent in Colorado Springs, I think this was in 1899, he went through $1 million in about 8 months.
And that was where, as you describe he started generating lightning.
Sure. I mean, he was trying to command lightning bolts out of the palm of his hand. So, yeah.
Which he did.
He would have his friends over to the laboratory, and one friend described it as he snapped his fingers and there was a ball of fire in his hand, and that he could then pass from person to person. He fancied himself a magician, but then insisted on the fact that it wasn't magic. You know, he had a lot of good ideas and a lot of ideas that were great but not true, or failures, but wonderful, wonderful failures.
And huge ambition. I mean, just almost unimaginable, like, I will control the weather.
Yeah, I will control the weather. He had one invention that scared a local precinct up on Mulberry Street, because it was a oscillating resonator that would just tap, tap, tap very gently, but hitting each time at the same point on the wavelength, so that very soon the waves were huge. And apparently from his laboratory on Houston, he was starting a small earthquake all over the Lower East Side. And so he made great claims. He was like, I could smash the world in two like an apple. You know, I'm going to halve it.
Did the fact that he was born in Eastern Europe and emigrated as a young man to the United States, did the Eastern European-ness add to this kind of media caricature as mad scientist?
I mean, imagine he's got this Serbian accent. And this is right at the buildup to World War I. And so we have Archduke Ferdinand, and certainly, I'm sure racism had a lot to do with it. And plus, he was a strange-looking man, a wonderfully handsome man. But he was over 6'2", and I think weighed 140 pounds. I mean, so really kind of very, very slender. And just an oddball.
And you suggest that there are people who actually thought he was from another planet or had traveled from the future.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. When he was out in Colorado Springs and working with really high voltage electricity, he set up a radio transmitter where he would sit and listen at night and thought that he was hearing messages from Mars and thought that he was also...
It was his version of SETI, as we know today.
Exactly, yeah. And not, you know, he wasn't saying I can translate what they say, but he was just saying, I think that there is life out there and I think that I've heard it in these radio waves. Interestingly enough, Lord Kelvin came to visit America and agreed with him on that. And he said, yes, I think Mars is also trying to contact us. Lord Kelvin wasn't laughed at. But as soon as Tesla got back to New York City, you know, the headlines were really horrible. He kind of immediately became a point of ridicule. And
never really lost that stigma.
In fact, the Superman comic book had a character named Tesla that was an evil mad scientist.
When Tesla was still alive?
Yeah, when Tesla was still alive. I mean, it must have just broken his heart.
Flash, true to his threat, the mad scientist, whose warnings have held the city in a grip of terror, went on his rampage of destruction on the stroke of midnight. The deadly impact of his mysterious ray smashed the famous Tower Bridge.
This looks like a job for Superman.
That's from Max Fleischer's version of Superman, a 1941 cartoon called The Mad Scientist. Megalomaniacal geniuses trying to dominate the world. Sounds like a lot of people in Hollywood, which is maybe why the movies are so full of mad scientists.
There's the bastard.
A man of science who sought to create a man after his own image, without reckoning upon God.
Gentlemen, my name is Dr. Evil. In a little while, you'll notice that the Kreplakistani warhead has gone missing.
See you in the future.
I made it with my own hands from the bodies I took from graves, from the gallows, anywhere.
The men who control the destiny of the world will be here.
It worked! I finally invent something that works!
It's alive! It's alive!
Vincent Parabone, a scientist at Yale, isn't mad, but he does get pretty ticked off by the way movies portray scientists.
Because I grew up in a small town in Florida, there were no scientists anywhere around me. Since most people don't know scientists, they interact with scientists mostly through film, I guess. Mr. Spock, for me, was my first introduction or exposure to a scientist.
Science Officer Spock, reporting as ordered, Captain. Please sit down.
There was the science officer. Just the concept of that, to me, still today. We unfortunately don't have that today. You know, we don't have a science officer in the White House.
I would say that was a logical assumption, Captain.
There was that yin and yang of him between being logical and scientific and being emotional. And scientists in film, anyway, are more likely to put people at risk for scientific gain. And I think this is a kind of a result of the atomic bomb era and one of the most horrific things that has ever been brought to the human race and brought to us in full color by scientists.
Dr. Strangelove, do we have anything like that in the works?
A moment, please, Mr. President.
One of my favorite movies, Dr. Strangelove, that character of his is so memorable, I think. This crazed German scientist who could conjure up this horrible mutual destruction device.
The doomsday machine is terrifying. It's simple to understand.
So there are these characterizations in film that like to hang on. If he's not an evildoer, he's at least not well-adjusted, disheveled, sloppy, disorganized. That's the general opinion of them. Independence Day, done by Roland Emmerich, which is Brent Spinner, the one who plays Data on Star Trek, plays a scientist who's working in Area 51.
This is the vault, or as some of us have come to call it, the freak show.
And this character is the worst character for science. He's this crazy Einstein-haired guy with his pants pulled up too high, and he's so consumed in his scientific research.
Can you tell us anything useful about him?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, they're not all that dissimilar from us.
He never thought it might be important to tell the rest of the country. And that, I thought, was very damaging because it gives this notion that scientists are somebody so involved in the study of what they do, they cannot be put in positions to make decisions. My favorite portrayal of a scientist comes from a Roland Emmerich film also, which is Dennis Quaid, who was in The Day After, which wasn't a very popular film, where he plays a climatologist.
Mr. Vice President, if we don't act now, it's going to be too late.
He's a handsome, attractive, well-adjusted guy, which is unusual for the scientific character in a film. When I watch these movies, I get jealous by the idea that in the Oval Office, there is a scientist brought in to answer questions. What's probably the most erroneous portrayal of scientists overall is that they are in some position of power. You know, scientists in reality have never been in any position of power, as far as I understand it. Certainly today, I know, at least the science that I work in, we really have no power whatsoever, and we're not particularly well-funded, and we're not particularly rich, so we can't hatch these elaborate evil schemes. And I don't understand where that ever really came from, where the idea that presidents really confide and rely and take advice and judgment from scientists. Unfortunately, I would say they often don't.
That's biologist Vincent Parabone. He studies the brain, and he co-wrote a book about bioluminescence.